The self-concept of a Christian disciple, Ephesians 4, 17 through 24, page 75 in whatever manual I'm looking at, and at the appropriate place, I'm sure, in the other manual. I've been here 2 days already, and I have found out you know where these things are better than I do, so I don't know why we bother giving you the page. I want to use our time most efficiently, particularly after how we have just been exhorted. And experience has proven that the most efficient use of time is reading. If you read, you have very little opportunity to digress, but I will digress also. We will have to get a little ways into the subject before I think that, so you see where we're going, before you will be ready to start asking questions, but at whatever time you think appropriate, please begin doing so as we did last night, and we will seek to respond. We will try to be clear. We need to have some overheads to use to spell the reading a little bit. The California Task Force to Promote Self-Esteem and Social Responsibility began meeting in Sacramento on March 25, 1986. Almost three-quarters of $1 million of state money has been budgeted over a three-year period to support the studies of this group, which is dedicated to solving of social problems through the promotion of self-esteem. This commission has an even greater claim to fame, however, in that it has recently attracted national attention in the United States by way of the satirical comic strip Doonesbury. I'm sure you don't get Doonesbury over here. You do? Oh, good for you. Doonesbury regards this particular study, the California Task Force to Promote Self-Esteem and Social Responsibility, as just another flaky California innovation. This is typical of what is going on in our country, and I somewhat suspect may be going on in your country too. Robert Shuler, of national and even international fame as a preacher, calls this particular discovery the 20th century Reformation. The discovery that what men need most is self-esteem. These are only two of among many reminders of how our society has become obsessed with dwelling upon what one thinks of himself. How should we as Christians respond to this particular cultural focus? Does a Christian have any biblically based input to add to current discussions of this nature? We surely do. The New Testament has loads to say about the mindset of the non-Christian and the mindset of the Christian. What happens to a believer at the point of his regeneration is relevant. We cannot divorce this from theological discussions in connection with the Christian. That is true. The New Testament goes even further than telling us about regeneration. The New Testament goes so far as to tell us what we should think about regeneration, what the believer's concept of a regenerated person should be. We find that very little attention has been devoted to this, however, and it has only been in the last 6 months that my own attention has been directed to it by a paper that I heard read in Boston in December of 1987. It seems that the matter of concept is more the focus of recent discussions than the idea of just purely a theological discussion of regeneration, and so we want to talk about the concept. What is our concept of a regenerated person? From a technical linguistic perspective, there is legitimacy in talking about a Christian's concept of himself. The mind is extremely important in the New Testament, far more important than is reflected by a lexical study of the principal word for mind and its cognates, the word nous. We have listed for you a list of 13 words that was proposed in this paper by Grant Osborne back in December. Words that are mind-related, they're in your syllabus, but we have expanded that slightly to give the English meaning or the corresponding idea that is related to all of these words. The word for nous or na'ain, this is a whole, this is a catalog of mind words. There's another word, phronein, which is a catalog of thought words. Logizestai, the reckoning words, they all, that for those pertain to the mind. Suniemi, perception words. Dokane, supposition words. Dokibadzane, sense words. Ginosko, adenai, knowledge words. Akuin, hearing words. Even cardia, heart words. And thelain bulistai, words that pertain to the will, the human will. Esso, anthropos, words that pertain to the inner man, or actually only this one expression that pertains to the inner man. And synaesthesis, words that pertain to the conscience. And Grant proposed that actually the New Testament says more about our mind than we have given it credit for. The title of this paper was The Place of the Mind in Christian Sanctification. And I am not going anywhere near the direction that he went in my development, but I do want to credit him with triggering some seed thoughts that we have sought to capitalize on. Now, I've got a long way to go in this study, as in that I've only begun it in the last few months. The paper that we're drawing from was actually climaxed by being read in an April 15th Theological Society meeting this year. So I'm confessing to being in the developmental stage to this, but it's something that's so important I wanted to share it with you this evening. I've taken one passage, Ephesians 4, 17 to 24, as a starting point, mainly because it is loaded down with mind words. And in the Greek text that is printed for you, we have these mind words, the ones from Osborne's list, underlined. And for the sake of whoever, we will give an English translation of this particular passage. Therefore I say this and solemnly affirm in the Lord, verse 17, that you no longer walk as also the Gentiles are walking in the vanity of their mind. There's the first one, nous, from the usual word for mind. Being darkened in understanding, another one, a compound word from the na'in group. Being alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance. There's a knowledge word in the negative form. Another mind word. Because of the ignorance which is in them on account of the hardness of their heart. Another mind word, biblically speaking. Who, being past feeling, have given themselves over to licentiousness for the working of all uncleanness and covetousness. But, the other part of the contrast, beginning in verse 20, but you have not so learned Christ, if indeed you have heard him, and here is another mind word that is in our list of 13, and have been taught in him, just as truth is in Jesus, that you put off the old man according to the former manner of life, the old man who is being corrupted according to the lust of deceit, and or but be renewed in the spirit of your mind. There's another one. And put on the new man who has been created according to God, the idea according to the image of God, in righteousness and holiness of truth. From this list, we have picked out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 mind words, and I'm proposing additions to Osborne's list just from this paragraph. The apeogeikatis in verse 19 being past feeling, which is a word that relates to the deadening of the conscience. And since the conscience is related to the mind, it would belong in the list. Emathete, verse 20, you have not so learned Christ, another mind word, obviously, from Montano, to learn. Edidaktete, you were taught, clearly another word pertaining to the intellect. And aletheia, which, though it could be used in other ways in this particular semantic field, would certainly be a mind word, just as the truth is in Jesus. And so you see that we actually have come up in this span with 11 occurrences of words in 8 verses that pertain to the mind. Now that should tell us something, shouldn't it? That should tell us something. Furthermore, as the paragraph evidently portrays, the use to which the mind is put in this paragraph clearly pertains to a Christian's self-perception. What do you think with your mind? What is your concept of yourself? Now, we are approaching this under two large headings, the place of Ephesians 470 to 24 in its context, and then the structure of Ephesians, general structure of Ephesians 4:17 to 24. The paragraph in question is connected to the previous context by the therefore, the un of verse 17. Abbott and others want to make resumptive, looking back to chapter 4, verses 1 to 3, meaning that verses 4 to 16 are taken as a parenthesis, but just very briefly, we think it is foolish to take such an extended section as a parenthesis, since there are things later than verse 24 which clearly build upon factors in verses 4 to 16. And so we would rather take un in the sense of deriving lessons to be learned and applied based on the entirety of verses 1 to 16, a logical conclusion based on the whole section without any parenthetical part. At the other side of the paragraph, verse 25, you have another inferential conjunction, another therefore or wherefore, dia, and it derives another inference. This time it is based on verses 17 to 24. Whatever it is that is to be learned from verses 17 to 24 becomes the basis for the exhortations, the commands and prohibitions regarding everyday life in verses 25 and following. Such commands as stop lying and to stop stealing have their basis in whatever the concept is that is being taught in verses 17 to 24. And then we go on to the general structure of verses 17 to 24. It falls into two parts, verses 17 to 19 and verses 20 to 24. The earlier part is Paul's plea to cease following the pattern of Gentile thought and behavior. The last half, verses 20 to 24, is his depiction of the opposite kind of mentality and life standards, those that should characterize the Christian life. So it's a very simple structure, two sides of the coin. This is what you were, stop living that way now. And the other side is this is what you are, and so think of yourself in this light. Now, verses 20 to 24 are most relevant to the purposes of our study. In verses 20 to 24, there are two major exegetical difficulties. One has a possible relationship to our purpose, but not definitely so, and it is the Kathos clause translated by King James as "the truth is in Jesus." The New International Version translates it "in accordance with the truth that is in Jesus." The New American Standard Bible says "just as the truth is in Jesus." The Reader's Digest Bible doesn't translate it. The only view that allows this clause to affect our understanding of the Christian self-concept is the one which does not take it as parenthetical. And without wearing you out completely, that view just won't hold water. So we will take it as it is punctuated in our English translation with a comma on each side and understand it as being a parenthetical thought. The best solution is to understand it as parenthetical, and when you do that, you come up with the relationship that we want to describe. The three infinitives of verses 22 to 24, the apothestai, that you put off, verse 22, the ananeustai, that you be renewed, verse 23, and the endusastai, that you put on, verse 24, all three of those go back to the edidoxete in verse 21. You were taught. These three infinitives are widely recognized as being substantival uses supplying a direct object for the passive verb edidoxete. This is the substance of the teaching. Three things: put off, be renewed, put on. So far, there is very little disagreement. The major issue revolves around a precise interpretation of the first and third infinitives, the two aorist infinitives, that you put off and that you put on. We have called out the three major possibilities of what these infinitives mean, and we have given them a name. We call them the positional view, the whole life view, and the crisis process view, found on page 76 in this manual that I'm looking at, and on whatever page you're looking at in the other one. The positional view holds that the aorist infinities of verses 22 and 24 look back to the putting off of the old man and the putting on of the new man at the time a person first trusted Christ for salvation. In other words, they speak of positional truth or factual data which is void of any element of command to be obeyed by the readers. He's not telling them that they have to do something. He's just reminding them of something that happened already. That's the positional view. The second view, the whole life view, takes the aorist infinitives as looking at the Christian life as a whole, that you are to think in terms of your whole post-conversion experience as characterized by the responsibility of putting off and putting on. And in this case, the infinitives are taken they take on the nature of admonitions. They become imperatival in effect. They are commands. This is your obligation that you put off and put on. The third view, the aorist infinitives look at a crisis decision that is made sometime post-conversion, some decision that is made in the Christian life subsequent to the time a person is saved, and the readers decide at that point to dispense with the mental and behavioral attitude of the Gentile world, and that they begin the process of Christian thinking and living. In this case, the two infinitives in question are aorist infinitives of an instantaneous type, and there is an imperatival notion involved in them. Now, the positional view is the one that is propagated, publicized quite a bit in this day and time. In translation, the positional view would be best represented by an English perfect tense. You were taught that you have put off the old man and that you have put on the new man. The idea is that Paul is telling his readers what happened to them at conversion, and telling them this will give them an incentive to quit living like the Gentiles, as they have been commanded to do in verses 17 to 19. In other words, this positional truth would supply the motivation to get the needed results. Recollection of the perfect change that transpired at the time of regeneration will accelerate experiential development, which at this stage is imperfect. John Stott offers two supports for this view. He calls attention to the parallel passage in Colossians 3, 9, and 10, where the two aorist participles, apekdousaminoi and endousaminoi, clearly refer to a change that took place at regeneration. And there in Colossians 3, they furnish an incentive to obey the earlier command, do not lie to one another, because you have put off the old man and you have put on the new. Since there are so many similarities between Ephesians and Colossians, Stott reasons that that must be the meaning here. I would respond that it is highly precarious, exegetically speaking, to interpret this passage in light of a passage from another book, in spite of the similarities between them. The movement of thought in these two epistles is distinctive, and we cannot assume identity of meaning in the two epistles. At this particular point, Henry Alford observes that Colossians brings out the intellectual side of the divine image of the new man. Ephesians looks at the ethical side of that divine image. Though quite similar, the two passages do have a difference between the lessons that are being taught. This is one thing we try to grill into the minds of our students in our emphasis upon exegetical method, that you must let each passage speak for itself, or else you deprive yourself of some specific contribution that is made by that passage and that passage only. Stott derives his other main proof from the context of Ephesians 4. He notes that the paragraph of ethical commands begun at verse 25 is based on 22 to 24. He reasons that one does not base commands on other commands. Rather, he bases them on doctrinal truths. He concludes, therefore, that 22 to 24 must be doctrinal truth rather than having any imperatival thrust. But Stott ignores another reasonable option here. If this paragraph is talking about the mind, as we think it is, and as we have sought to demonstrate already, it is very reasonable to command a group of Christians, first of all, to get your thinking straight, and then your activities can be straightened out on the basis of that. And we think that that is just as plausible an explanation as the one that Stott proposed. Stott's theory falters in particular in its inability to explain the second of the three infinitives, the ananeustai, a present infinitive which he acknowledges, and everybody else that I've seen acknowledges, is a command. The command is to allow the Holy Spirit to keep on renewing you in the spirit of your mind. This is something that is to be ongoing and something that is to continually characterize the Christian experience. Well, it is very difficult to see how, if that second infinitive is a command, as everyone agrees that it is, the first and third could not be commands, should not be commands also. A very significant weakness, we think, in his viewpoint. Another rather conspicuous deficiency in the positional view is its relegation of the old man to the past alone. In chapter 4, verse 22, a present participle, ton pheromenon, the old man, which is being corrupted. It is an ongoing process right now. And you can hardly relegate an ongoing process of corruption to an entity which belongs only to the past. A contrast between this participle, ton pheromenon, which is being corrupted or who is being corrupted, and the aorist participle in verse 23-24, the new man who has been created, the contrast between the two is marked. The old man who is in the process of being corrupted, the new man who has been created once for all. Since the old man is still being corrupted, he must still exist in the life of the regenerated person. Now, in the interest of time, we would like to dispense with the whole life view very quickly. The good thing about it is it does allow the imperatival force to be assigned to those two aorist participles, as we think it should. But the bad thing about it is it fails to explain the difference between the present infinitive and the two aorist infinitives. Clearly, some distinction was in mind because Paul is not noted for varying his tenses just for the sake of literary effect, as a classical writer might have done. When a differentiation of this type occurs in side-by-side words, the probability is very strong that a difference in meaning is intended, and this particular view just does not provide for that difference between the tenses of those infinitives. And so we move on to the crisis process view, which, as you would suspect by its being in third position, is the good guy. The crisis process view notices an ethical need in the lives of the readers who, though already converted, continue to follow behavioral patterns resembling the Gentiles surrounding them. To remedy this, Paul calls upon them to resolve within themselves to put off the old man and to put on the new, and to continue in this train of thought about themselves from that point, from the point of this initial decision into the indefinite future. There is to be a decisive break, which is indicated by the two aorist infinitives. And since the old man clings with a person even after that decisive break, the present infinitive points to the continuous renewal subsequent to the break. We might render it this way. You were taught that you ought to put off the old man once for all, but that you ought to be continually renewed, and that you ought to put on the new man once for all. Westcott puts it this way, the first and third acts are done once for all, and the decisive change is comprehended gradually by the second infinitive. The advantage of this life over the whole life view is it gives us a rationale for a difference between the two tenses of the participles, of the infinitive rather. Its advantage over the positional view is that it allows for an imperatival force for all three infinitives and not just for the second one. As Barth observes, the central concern of this context is ethical, and it deals with the present, not with the past or the future. This is something he wants his readers to do right now. Now, what about the imperatival thrust of verses 20 to 24? The presence or absence of an imperatival force is very strategic in what happens to a person at regeneration and what we're to think of ourselves in light of our regeneration. As noted above, Stott rules out such of an imperatival force because of the parallel passage in Colossians and because of the subsequent context in Ephesians 4:25. There are other objections to this imperatival force, but we don't want to get into that kind of detail. They're not of any consequence, really. Lenski points out that the infinities are not based on the parakalo of verse 1, and therefore he is not calling on his readers to do what these infinitives state. This challenge by Lenski calls for an observation. it calls for a closer scrutiny of the paragraph in the broader context. Alford notes that these infinitives depend on the didactate of verse 21, you were taught, and therefore carry on the imperatival force, as does the infinitive of verse 17. In verse 17, I say and I solemnly affirm that you stop walking. Clearly, the force of a command. The verbs, lego maturamai, particularly the maturamai, is a strong word. Almost to the effect, I put you under oath that you stop walking. The addition of the in Kurio, in the Lord, makes it even more powerful. These elements make it clear that the apostle has reached the climax of an escalating intensity of plea to his readers, which began in 3:1 and was carried on in 3:13 and 14, and then in chapter 4, verse 1, I beseech you that you walk worthy of the calling with which you have been called. We've now reached a climax in his plea to his readers that they bring their lives into line with the highest standards of Christian living. He is he is exhorting them to do this. The prohibitive part of the command in verse 17, that you no longer walk, is the other side of the coin. And along with those verbs, I say and solemnly affirm that we just referred to in verse 17, the infinitives carries the idea of what ought to be, and it is carries very much the same force as a command. With meketi, the no longer walk, a present tentative infinitive of this type prohibits the continuation of what has been characteristic of their lives up until this point. In essence, the writer is beseeching his readers to stop their Gentile-like conduct. Apparently, that which has characterized their Christian lives up to this point. The broader context supports this objective as well. If we go all the way back to chapter 4, verse 1, we have an aorist infinitive of the verb for walk. I beseech you that you walk. Probably the idea of that you begin to walk with in a way that is in accord with your calling. The contrast between the present infinitive in verse 17 and the aorist infinitive of verse 1 emphasizes the distinction between them once again. The aorist is looking at the command to begin a new lifestyle, verse 1, while the present with the prohibition in verse 17 is telling them to stop something that has been going on up until the present. And as we move into the second section of the epistle, rather the section beginning at verse 25, we have a series of prohibitions, and I'm not going to try to read them all to you, but we've got two of them in verse 26, one in 27, 28, 29, 30, 5 threes, 5 six, 5 seven, 5 11, 5 17. All have prohibitions with a present imperative introduced by a may, or a present tense introduced by a may. They are imperatives too. The pattern of life of these readers needed a radical change. Stop doing this. Stop doing this. Stop doing this. That is the force. We talk about the low ethical standard of the Corinthian church. It wasn't very high here in Asia either, where this epistle was addressed. Such a change agrees with the conclusion that they had to put off the old man. That was their obligation, verse 22. And that they had to put on the new man, verse 24, it needed to become an experiential happening in their lives. I think we've labored the point enough. There are other reasons why we do need that imperatival force in the infinitive. But let's summarize these injunctions then in verses 20 to 24. The standard of living of the addressees of this epistle was very low, resembling that which characterized the Gentiles around him. them, they had been taught to put off the old man and to put on the new, but they had not yet done it. Even though as a positional transaction, this had taken place in their lives already. Romans 6:6 and Colossians 3:9 and 10. They are urged by Paul at this point to incorporate this reality into their behavior by making a clean break with these Gentile habits and embracing the characteristics of the new man in day-by-day experience. This decisive break is then to become a part of their ongoing pattern of life through the renewal of the spirit of their minds, which they are directed to allow the Spirit of God to carry out. Whatever else this renewal of the spirit of the mind may include, it surely includes a constant awareness of the potential danger of allowing the old man to regain his control and the potential high caliber of life attainable while the new man remains experientially in place. A proper Christian perception includes a constant focus on this fact, and thus the need for a continued renewal of the mind. Here's the way that Linsky states it. It is quite true that the old man still clings to us after the decisive break, and thus must be put away again and again. That is why Paul adds the iterative present infinitive, but that you continue to be renewed, and so forth. Paul's view is one definite decisive break, then a continuous renewal, which is a conceptual renewal. That's the end of the quotation. In a more practical vein, Lloyd-Jones speaks to the same effect. Quote, when the apostle tells us to put off the old man and put on the new man, he is not calling for a mechanical conformity, but asking us to put into practice an intelligent change. That is his reason for speaking of being renewed in the spirit of your mind in between the putting off and the putting on. If the spirit of our mind is changed and is renewed, we shall be thinking in such a way that we shall put off the old man and will put on the new man. That's the end of that quotation. In another place, he says this, we are no longer what we were, and the first thing we have to do is to tell ourselves just that. The whole art of Christian living is to know how to talk to yourself. You start your day by telling yourself, now I am the new man, I am no longer the old man. My old man has been crucified with Christ, my old man is dead, finished with, he is non-existent, I am no longer what I was. You start the new day by saying that to yourself. It will not be said to you. It will not happen automatically. End of quote. What a choice emphasis. We have the responsibility of reminding ourselves. It is not automatic. That is a tremendous, tremendously important lesson in regard to self-concept. This is the experiential side of the positional truth regarding our old man and new man. It has also been spoken of as the tension between the already and the not yet that is so characteristic of Pauline letters. To fail to carry out this responsibility can only mean failure along practical lines. Successful Christian living begins by the possession of the proper self-concept. It is a dual perception, not a single perception. The dual perception of ourselves includes the ever-present danger of lapsing back into the habits of the old man, and number two, the ever-present potential of appropriating the higher type life for which the new man stands. Neither can be omitted. Both must be the objects of conscious apprehension. You've patiently borne with me through some rather technical jargon, and we would like to call your attention more broadly, after working through this passage in some detail, to other passages. Yes, sir. It is a dual perception, the ever-present danger of lapsing back into the habits of the old man, and the ever-present potential of appropriating the higher type of life for which the new man stands. You get it? The ever-present danger of lapsing back into the habits of the old man. Now, this, sir? If you've got one, go ahead.
I've got three.
Three? All right.
Just the first one's a very quick one. Ekasada in verse 21. Is that subjunctive or indicative?
The edidaktete. It's aorist passive indicative.
Ekasada.
Sir.
Ekasata.
I understand you.
My Australian, of course.
Yes, my
in verse 21. The Greek ekasata.
Ekusata.
Is that helpful?
I'm on the wrong page here. Just a minute.
The fourth Greek word in verse 21 of the text that you've reproduced.
The fourth Greek word in verse 21, the ekousate.
That's it.
You got it.
That's an indicative.
Yeah, right. Okay. That's fine.
Right.
So he's talking about the if could be translated since. So he's talking to converts. That's
you
the
have,
first thing.
Since you've heard and have been taught
fine.
In him.
The second question was, in the light of Romans 6:6, are you saying that Paul's using the old man in a different way in Romans 6:6
yes.
as he is here?
Yes, there in Romans 6:6, it's talking about the already or the positional truth.
Right.
Here it's talking about the not yet or the experiential side of it.
Okay. In that case, is there a post-conversion crisis experience that we're talking about here?
Yes.
Where the old man is put off post-conversion, or are you talking about an ongoing appropriation?
He's talking about a crisis where that appropriation begins, and the ongoing aspect of it is covered in the renewing of the mind.
Right, so we're looking almost at a Martin Lloyd-Jones type post-conversion experience?
Yes, sir.
Right, fine, thank you.
Yes, he was the one I quoted extensively in this regard.
So you would agree with the theology as far as the post-conversion experience?
I think that he hit the nail on the head right there.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
So, yeah, it is quite a Wesleyan view, yeah.
There it
is. Yeah. What's that?
It sounds like a very Wesleyan, almost Keswickian viewpoint.
This particular concept is not completely, well, it is not limited to this passage, we're going to have to hurry and be brief and not say nearly as much as we would like to about some of these, but I have just very briefly put together a number of passages elsewhere in the epistles where this same type of expectation is expressed. This, I think, is what is spoken about in Romans 6:11. Reckon yourselves to be dead indeed unto sin. And it's a present tense, and by the way, it's one of our mind words, isn't it? Logizomai, reckon. This is your self-concept. But alive to God, the positive side, the putting on of the new man, in union with Christ Jesus. Also in Romans 7:4, Paul, in comparing the experience of the believer to the woman whose husband is now dead so that she is free to marry another. He says you were put to death, but now you've been married to him who was raised, and you have that same dual picture in a figure, so to speak. Perhaps the most subtle of these, and Cranfield, in his excellent two-volume commentary on Romans in the revised NIC, picks up this thing and absolutely correct. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, living zosan as it is used consistently through Romans to speak of our resurrected life with Christ, and sacrifice to portray the death side. The dual concept, the figure in which we are to present ourselves. Galatians 2:20. I have been crucified with Christ, but I live. How do you get around that? We have to have a dual concept of ourselves. It's paradoxical, but it's true. In Galatians 5:24, only one side of it, those who belong to Christ have crucified the flesh. And I haven't come all the way, but I'm pretty much to the point that George Ladd expresses in his New Testament theology that in Paul the flesh is identical with the old man. And so here we have the negative side or the death side of that duality expressed once again. And Ephesians 4:22 and 24, we have just been over. Colossians 3:1-3, you were raised with Christ, and then a couple of verses later he says you died. The dual concept once again. The 1 Peter 2:24, that having died to sin, you might live to righteousness. There it is again. And probably the toughest one of all, and this is a whole separate lecture at least, 1 Peter 4:1, the one who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. And in the setting of 1 Peter, the end of 1 Peter 3 and 1 Peter 4, suffering in the flesh equals death. If you've died, you've ceased from sin. And there are various explanations from that, but when you weigh all of the exegetical factors, I believe he's talking practically about the same thing that Paul does in Romans 6:11. Reckon yourselves to be dead to sin, but alive to God. Now, where did all of this come from? And I'm going way beyond the scope of what I'm qualified to talk about here, but I believe in living dangerously. Where did it come from? I have called out a series of texts from the Gospels pertaining to discipleship. In Galilee, toward the end of the great Galilean ministry, when Jesus sent forth the ten, this was part of his instructions to them. The one who finds his life will lose it, and the one who loses his life for my sake will find it. And if you examine the words closely and the paradoxical use of psuche there, where in one case it's bodily temporal life, in the other case it's eternal lasting life, you essentially have the same dual concept of death and life. At Caesarea Philippi, about 6 months later, toward the conclusion of the period of training the 12 in the areas around Galilee, Jesus revealed to the disciples this, among other things, and here we are going to save a little mileage. Matthew 16:24-25 is parallel to Mark 8 and Luke 9, so we'll read only the first one here. Then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone desires, and there is a mind word, by the way, thele, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Let him, crisis experience, aorist imperative, deny himself, crisis experience, take up his cross. In other words, the path of suffering leading to death if necessary. And follow me, present tense, keep on following me, the same general pattern. For whoever desires to save his life, there it is again, will lose it. And whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. And same dual concept. You see, I think what I'm leading up to, I believe that this line of teaching, which is repeated so often in the ministry of Christ, was picked up on by Paul and Peter, as well as the rest of the church, and developed in different ways, but with essentially the same duality all the way through. Coming down to the end of Christ's ministry, early in the Perean ministry, the 3 months right before Passion Week, We have in essence this the same truth in Luke 14:27. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. The picture of bearing your cross. And once again, toward the end of that same three-month period of the Perean ministry and just before Passion Week in Luke 17:33, whoever seeks to save his life for himself will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it alive. We're talking about death and life. Yes, sir.
Talking about this dual life thing, and I'm not sure that I have this fully clear here, that you're talking about in the midst of some point of Christian life. Was not Jesus talking to these people who were considering the Christian life?
He speaks in absolute terms to them, and he's speaking about spiritual death and spiritual life, and it is a dual concept. But I believe that as it has been applied by the apostles to those who are already Christians but who haven't made that crisis decision, they apply it perhaps in a slightly different way. The only thing I'm trying to learn, and I'm still learning it, I hope. I've got a long way to go because this is turning into a huge project. I believe that this is portraying what the concept of a disciple should be of himself, that he should picture himself in the role as of an old man and in the role of a new man in order to explain the impulses that come to him in his efforts to live the Christian life and deal with them intelligently. And I probably shouldn't try to explain to you the theological nuances at this point because I don't have them worked out fully myself. But I'm trying to generalize at this point. Now, the Monday of Passion Week, the Monday before Christ's crucifixion, John 12:25 is particularly enlightening. It essentially says the same thing as we've been reading already. The one who loves his life will lose it, and the one who hates his life in this world will guard it for eternal life. But the surrounding verses of John 12:25 are tremendously enlightening. The occasion is the coming of Greeks for an audience with Jesus. And the response of Jesus to these Greeks who come is not to give them an audience, but simply to say, verse 23, Jesus answers to them saying, the hour has come for that the Son of Man should be glorified. Verse 24, verily, verily, I say to you, except a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it abides alone. But if it dies, it brings forth much fruit. Unless there's been death in some fashion, there will be no fruitfulness. You say, but that's talking about Jesus. It is talking about Jesus. But who else is it talking about? Verse 25, the one who loves his life loses it. And the one who hates his life will guard it to life eternal. He hates his life in this world, will guard it to life eternal. And what's true of Jesus is true of his disciple. There's got to be death there too. If any man serves me, let him follow me. Verse 26. And where I am, there will my servant also be. And so the same dual concept picture. You say, what's so profound about that? What are you leading up to? Well, let's get to what we're leading up to because the time is gone. And I always believe in apologizing once we reach the time limit so that folk will understand when we go beyond that we are sorry for what we're doing. on page 78 of your Your Deal, or whatever other page. We have sought to illustrate just one contemporary writer who deals with self-concept. This is David C. Needham's book, Birthright, Christian, Do You Know Who You Are? We could go many other places, to Naramore, to Schuller, to you name it, among modern Christian psychologists and counselors. They all have one thing in common. They all develop a man-centered system and devote only passing attention to how God is involved in an adequate view of oneself. But we'll concentrate only on Needham. We find in Needham from the outset his anthropocentric orientation in his definition of sin. Sin is, quote, the expression of man's struggle with the meaning of his existence while missing life from God. That's what sin is. I'll continue the quote. It is all the varieties of ways man deals with and expresses his alienation from his Creator as he encounters the inescapable issue of meaning. At another place, he says, the essence of sin, then, cannot be separated from the essence of meaning. Now, the human orientation of this definition is too clear to need elaboration. Needham almost comes to the point of refuting his own definition of sin when discussing mataiates in Ephesians 4:17, which we've looked at a moment ago. Mataiates, which characterizes the Gentile mind, is a word for aimlessness or futility. The Gentile mind has no concept of meaning, and it is foolish to say that he is searching for meaning. A Gentile has no purpose. His thoughts are characterized by emptiness and vanity. He is not looking for meaning, yet he still sins. And so I don't think this sin is adequate. This definition of sin is adequate. Now, Needham comes out of a background probably similar to what you and I have come from, and he is rebelling against that background. He emphatically asserts that a Christian is a saint, not just positionally, or judicially, or experientially, but actually. In other words, he rejects the possibility of a tension between the almost and the not yet in regard to Christianity, and even goes to the extreme of relieving Christians of any obligation of obedience to such commands as Romans 6:11. Yet reckon yourselves to be dead to sin, but alive to God. That's a command to be obeyed. Yet this teaching to be in practice what the calling of God has made you in common, is common in Paul's writings. F.F. Bruce expresses it this way. Believers, in fact, and in conscious experience exist on two planes so long as mortal life endures. Spiritually, they already belong to the age to come, while temporally, they are involved in the present age. Spiritually, they are united to Christ at God's right hand, while temporally, they live on earth. The impartation of the new nature by Christ does not effect the immediate annihilation of the old hereditary nature. So long as they live in this world, the old nature persists like a dormant force which may spring into activity at any time. Hence the tension which arises not from any inconsistency between Paul's premises and his recognition of the facts of human life, but from well-known conditions of human existence. Needham rejects that tension. He says it is not there. He says our old man is dead, period. Needham proceeds to reject the existence of the old man in the life of the regenerated person, and goes so far as to endorse the statement of Griffith Thomas that believers are never exhorted to put off the old man. Well, we hope we have dealt with that already. This possibility runs completely counter to Ephesians 4:22-24, which we have just studied. One cannot help fearing that Needham has fallen into one of the two possible errors cited by one of his favorite resources, D.M. Lloyd-Jones. The error is that of putting on the new man and not troubling to put off the old man at the same time. In light of the Ephesians passage discussed at the beginning of this study, this is certainly a valid appraisal of his teaching. Another peculiarity of Needham's theory is that the flesh is still with the regenerate person, even though the old man is no longer present. This allows the possibility of saying that it is not the essential, deepest nature of a regenerate person who sins, but it is his flesh. Wouldn't that be great? I'm a great guy. I never sin. My flesh does, but I don't. He notes the danger of concluding that the person therefore bears no blame for his sin, since it is attributable to the person's flesh, not to his essential nature. Yet it is difficult to reach any other conclusion given the data which he furnishes regarding the true self. For Needham, this theory regarding the ongoing effect of the flesh runs counter to the same problem of the tension between the already and the not yet that was cited. And he has a real problem dealing with Galatians 5:24 and devotes his whole Appendix C to trying to get around that problem. And I'm going to skip down to the summary that you have printed out for you and hope that we have described Needham sufficiently for you to get a picture of why he thinks we can think such great things of ourselves. I am now the new man and the new man only, and whatever wrong may come from me is not from me in my deeper inmost self. It is from my flesh, and so I can have a pretty good self-image of myself. Number one, he is right about the creation and ongoing existence of the new man beginning with a person's regeneration, but he is wrong about this being the total essence of a Christian's essential deepest nature. Number two, he is right about the old man's crucifixion belonging to the past, but he is wrong about the potential continuing effect of the old man on the life of a Christian. It is still there. Number three, he is right about the present influence of the flesh upon Christian behavior, but he is wrong about denying the past crucifixion of the flesh. Galatians 5:24 states that the flesh has been crucified in the past just as the old man has. And so I believe he makes a basic error here. He is wrong in rejecting an inevitable tension between the already and the not yet in the Christian life. I don't think you can deal with biblical passages adequately unless you allow that there is this tension existing about our inner persons. He is wrong in building his definition of sin around man's quest for meaning rather than around his attempt to be independent of God. And six, he is wrong for eliminating the human responsibility of a constant reckoning regarding one's death and resurrection with Christ. What I hope somebody will do, if I don't get around to it, is proceed and deal in detail with these other passages that we have only glanced at, as well as dealing with more contemporary pictures of what one's self-concept should be. But I believe that what we are getting most often is an oversimplified picture of what we should think of ourselves. We're only getting half the picture. We're being told to think good things and good things only about ourselves. We're told that the picture of a wholesome emotional existence is to have a positive self-image. That's only a half-truth. That's only a half-truth. And a half-truth is error. Yes, sir. Do you have a hand up? Well, I see a similarity, yes. But it's come to us in such a sophisticated way these days where it is the presupposition of secular psychology that you're mentally off if you don't have a positive self-image of yourself. It is taken on the trappings of a highly sophisticated philosophical concept, and so it's been dressed up quite a bit.
The other point is that Needham
Yes, sir. I think that's true. Name?
Comment on Romans 8:13 in the light of, but if through the Spirit the practices of the body you put to death, you will live.
What's that now?
Romans 8:13.
Mortify your bodies, is that the one?
No, it says, for you must, but if by the Spirit the practices of the body you put to death, you will live. Some, I understand, would believe that the practices, the idea of the habits that follow on afterwards, in other words, would hold a positional view number one that you described, and yet there are habits that still hold on. Would you care to comment on that, please, in light of Romans 8:13?
Romans 8:13. I would have to relate it in some way with this dual concept that we've been talking about. I guess I'm not sure exactly how. I would probably take it as the experiential side of that concept. You have been put to death, and so you, if you live according to the flesh, you're about to die. That would be the exact opposite sequence there, though, and that may be a purely futuristic melete, or you will die. I think, don't you, in Romans 8, that Paul is making it all black and white. You're either saved or you're unsaved. And so he's saying that if this is the way you're living and this is the way only, then you will die spiritually, probably. He's not making any allowance for the in-between Christian life in that chapter, I don't think. I hope I've satisfied your question, but I really had not thought through the issue to that point yet. But it would be relevant, as you say. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Are you saying that every Christian has to come to a point in their lives that they'll have this experience where they'll go on to live a way that is totally of Christ, and the flesh won't have any harm of them at all?
I think that the picture that is generally presented is that most of us do not attain that level of dedication at the point of conversion. It would be ideal if we did, and I think there are some who do. But for most, as is apparently the case in the lives of the recipients of the Epistle to the Romans, it was necessary that something happened subsequent to salvation. And I see that as a crisis, but then the future need to live in the light of that decision that had been made at that point, portrayed as putting off and putting on in Ephesians 4. And up until that point, it's very difficult for a person to have assurance of his salvation, I think. I'm not saying he's not saved, but it's very difficult for a person who hasn't done that to be sure that he is saved.
The importance of teaching new converts the real truths of the Scriptures.
Amen.
Straight away.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
Amen. Yes, sir.
Would you take that Ephesians 4 thing there then as being a single experience after conversion, or the possibility of multiple experiences throughout Christian life?
I take it as being the first and third infinitives as being something that comes at a particular moment in the Christian life, and the second infinitive as a constant focus of the mind upon that has transpired.
If this lapses, then surely you're back to the point where the crisis has to reoccur.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand you. It's my hearing, it's not your speaking, believe me.
If that continuing focus of the mind then lapses, is this not then a need for the crisis
then
to reoccur?
Then the Christian begins to experience defeat, and such as the stealing and lying and so forth that follows in the paragraph below.
So
the Ephesians 4 experience may be something which happens several times in a Christian life.
I think it's better conceived of as happening only once, and are either living in the light of it or not living in the light of it. And rather than saying it happens a second time, I would say that we come back to the right focus of our minds upon what we did previously. We're perhaps quibbling over semantics there, but that, I think, would be, to me, a better way of expressing it.